When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, the Russian president has said that Russia's military operation was a preemptive move against future aggression. Sentiments were received warmly in the Russian capital at the Victory Day parade, but not in Ukraine, where fighting is raging, and not in the U.S., who is keen on keeping this war going. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the different dynamics involved in this war and where the future stands, especially the world economic standing. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us, activist and commentator Don DeBar, joins us from Westchester, New York, and we also have lawyer, writer, historian, and former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas, who joins us from Geneva.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Alfred de Zayas, let me first start with you. We're looking at Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Basically, the way that the Russian President Vladimir Putin described it today, of which there were many descriptions in his view of why this special military operation happened, it was a preemptive move against what he called future aggression. He capitalized on that and said that Russia had to act, and I'm quoting him, because a large-scale offensive against the breakaway republics in the eastern Donbass region was being planned. Are you convinced by Vladimir Putin's explanation there?
Well, this information has been in the public domain already several weeks. We do know that Zelensky was committed to retake the Donbass by force, and evidently there was also a decision to attack sooner or later Crimea. Now, as a professor of international law and as a former rapporteur, I devoted one of my reports to the General Assembly on the right of self-determination of peoples. And I think it should be the function of the United Nations to conduct self-determination referenda in all countries where there is conflict. As a matter of fact, the realization of self-determination is a conflict prevention measure. And the war didn't start on the 24th of February 2022. You know as well as I do that the war started on the 22nd of February 2014, 8 years ago, at the coup d'etat against the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych. And there, of course, the West, NATO countries, the United States, my country of nationality, were deeply involved in the organization and in the financing of that coup d'etat. So you have here a problem of internationalization of this dispute. You have Ukraine being armed to the teeth since 2014, not since January or February 2022. So the resilience of the Ukrainian army and the fact that they have survived this long is a direct consequence of the enormous armaments that my country, the United States and the United Kingdom and other NATO countries have delivered to the Ukraine, and the logistical support, the intelligence support that has been given.
Okay, could I jump in and just make sure we understand you correctly here? Since you're saying that this is something that broke out in 2014, are we to conclude from what you just said there You're saying that it's not, as you said, something that has happened since January in terms of arming Ukraine, but it has happened since 2014 up to this point, that has continued, which is why they were able to hold out. Is that what you're saying?
People say, well, you know, Putin is unsuccessful. He is failing in his attempt to overwhelm Ukraine. Well, he never intended to overwhelm Ukraine. He intended to render Ukraine no longer a military danger. That's why he's focused primarily on destroying the military targets, the railroads.
Let me jump in then and bring Don DeBar. And Don DeBar, I'm mentioning what Putin said because he's explaining himself, and I think it's worth mentioning. And another quote by him, we saw the military infrastructure unfolding in Ukraine, hundreds of foreign advisors starting their work. There were regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries. The danger grew every day.
You know, let's get an idea of the scale of what we're talking about. And first of all, I would venture to say that perhaps the war began even before 2014. Certainly, the preparations for the coup that took place over a few years prior to that were part of the same war. Planning is part of the war. It's also a war crime to plan a war. Particularly one that's actualized. But I would say going back to the first time they crossed the Elbe with NATO after promising in order to induce Russia to be the only of the four powers to abandon its occupation of Germany, even though it was the most horribly damaged party in the world, more horribly damaged than the United States, Britain, and France combined, and also in terms of body count, including the Jews that the Nazis killed. The Soviet Union lost almost 30 million people, okay? And people quibble over 6 million people or not in the Holocaust. Granting 6 million, that's five times as many people. The United States lost in the six figures numbers, okay? And so the Soviet Union abandoned its occupation of Germany on a promise that NATO would not fill that space up and come forward. And they are now at the borders of Russia. Inside the Soviet Union, they have the three Baltics, they have half of Ukraine, and just for a little scale here, the aid, quote-unquote, the military assets that are being transferred to Ukraine just in the first 7 months of this year, what's being budgeted, the $33 million and the $13 or $14 billion that have been handed over, annualize out to about $80 billion. Russia's entire annual military budget is $65 billion for 2021. So we and also Germany and Britain and France and Italy are sending arms to Ukraine as well. That's on top of the numbers I just cited. So in terms of the scale of the threat that President Putin is referring to in terms of military infrastructure being set up, we're talking about something massive. And this is in the one area, the European theater of Russia. Their $65 billion also is part of their defense in the Eastern theater in Asia.
Well, Don DeBar, so again, great facts that you're stating here. Obviously, I'm guessing the NATO member countries, and in particular the U.S., they're all aware of this. But the general public is not. And, of course, the long-term memory perhaps doesn't serve the whole world, which conveniently, I guess, they have shut down Russia's, for example, RT in particular, who obviously wants these types of facts to go out. And, of course, our station also, as we're broadcasting what you have said. So that becomes an information war in a sense. But what's amazing about this is that Putin is being demonized, Alfred Isaias, in the way that he is, because he has been called a war criminal. He has been called by the U.S. President Joe Biden, and I forgot the other way that he was
Steinmeier by the German president also.
Right. So is that something that I mean? I'm not trying to promote violence nor deaths or civilians being targeted. So putting that aside, is it correct to put him in that context as the U.S. president has?
Well, demonization of a rival is, of course, primarily for local consumption. Since the United States and NATO are aggressors in so many countries, in order to sell it to the public. We are nominally a democratic country, and you have to indoctrinate people in hating the enemy. So we have unilaterally declared Russia and China to be our enemies. And as in George Orwell's 1984, there's something called hate week. Hate week is an exercise in hate. And that is organized and conducted by the government and by the government's proxies. And that is what we have been doing for many, many years. We have a problem here of having brainwashed a large swathe of the American public into hating Russia, into canceling Russian culture, canceling Anna Netrebko and Valery Gergiev, and canceling, Tchaikovsky concerts and all sorts of things. This is like in 2003 when we canceled the French and when we rebaptized French fries, freedom fries, etc. It's an enormous machinery of propaganda, and this information war actually works. The majority of the American population doesn't think like I do, or doesn't think like John Mearsheimer does, or like Stephen Kinzer does, or like Francis Boyle or Dan Kovalik thinks, or Marjorie Cohn. The American public tends to think my country right or wrong, and we are by definition the good guys, and we have a mission to bring democracy to Russia, uh-huh. Not only to the Ukraine. We want regime change in Russia.
That was my next question. I'm glad you brought that up because, they say that Biden, it was a slip, and they had to come and clean that up, so to speak, the damage that caused. But isn't that the ultimate intention, Don DeBar, when it comes to the U.S. intentions in Russia? Of course, they're going at it in terms of the economic strangulation as much as they can. At the same time, of course, militarily, they're trying to bring the Russian military to its knees. But ultimately, do you think that's their goal?
Well, that's been the goal since 1917. That's the longest running and most expensive project in human history that has been regime change in Russia, in the Soviet Union. From what Churchill, vowing that reporting that that Bolshevik baby needed to be suffocated in its crib, to the $1 trillion military, spending, $10 trillion, $50 trillion between 1945 and last Tuesday, all geared to dominate Russia and China, to remove the impediments to the utilization by the people that own the United States and Europe and everything else that they could put their hands on, to have access to the resources, the mineral resources and the human resources, without another rival on the planet. That is their objective. They're very clear about it. Brzezinski was clear about it. He wrote about it. He said it on tape a million times. Kissinger, a lot lessers, including some of the clowns they have in power now. This past week, five or six that I saw on tape say, of members of Congress, said we are at war with Russia. They say that we are now. Biden says regime change. Some others have said that too, a little more credible. And if that's true, first of all, I'm in the middle of working on, we've been trying to organize people to write something to their member of Congress to say, make Biden stop or impeach him. We can't have a war with Russia. Nobody's interested in that. But the problem we have is this. I remember in 2018 when the shrink who used to be at Yale, who got fired for these kinds of antics, there were three or four or five, it ended up being 700 psychiatrists that signed a letter expressing their fear of Donald Trump because he was unhinged. And this was because of a phone call, a nighttime tweet that he made making reference to North Korea, saying to Kim Jong-un, you've got a button, but I've got a bigger one and mine works. They thought he was unhinged. This was an unnecessary risk of nuclear war. This guy here, who can't remember whether or not he put on pants, literally, You can see how addled he is.
Right.
Has us at Russia's border at war with Russia, pumping in as much money and equipment as Russia spends on its own.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, Alfred Desaias, when you see the amount of energy, money, backing, support that comes through the military door, not only by the U.S., but also by the NATO member countries, which many analysts say it's the pressure from the U.S. that is making them do that, because on the side, you have military manufacturers that are jumping up and down, obviously looking at their ticker, on Wall Street, seeing how much money is being made. But yet, when it comes to diplomacy, silence. As a former U.N. Special Rapporteur, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's clear that our geopolitical interest is full spectrum dominance. That's what we want. And we have to sell it to the American people. That we do through propaganda and double standards. But what's interesting is that we can make a 20-year war in Afghanistan, United States, United Kingdom, NATO countries, completely fail in obtaining what we claimed that we wanted. But of course, the military-industrial complex laughed all the way down to the back. Yep. I mean, it's the military-industrial complex that rules the United States. It is what you might call the deep state that is behind this war, and that is what prevents Zelensky from reaching a diplomatic solution, because he could have had a diplomatic solution in January, in February, in the first days of the war. And there have been negotiations nonstop with the Ukrainians and the Russians. And the solution was simply neutrality and no membership in NATO. Mm-hmm. And no further threatening with major, you know, missiles and heavy weapons next to the border of the Donbas and next to the border of Russia. That's what it's about. But of course, we in the United States don't get this information. You can get it in the internet if you proactively look for it.
Sure,
you
sure.
Have to look for it.
I have to ask you this, Don DeBar. It's a little bit outdated, but I'm really curious as to what your thoughts are when you either read, heard, or saw the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi going to Ukraine. I mean, she could have done a Skype. What was the reason behind her being there, other than the fact that, and this is just an opinion here, to make sure to give the support that Zelensky, I'm not too sure, was looking for from Nancy Pelosi, but to endorse the fact that he should keep on going with the war. God forbid that he might have thoughts about wanting to resolve this.
Yeah, I mean, all I can do is speculate also, of course. But I mean, first of all, a deduction that I've made, that's all it is. But if you do a close review of every visit by people, you know, administration, congressional representatives, European officials, et cetera, to quote Kiev, since the 26th or 27th of February, you're going to find out that you don't see a single active street scene without the, debris of a matting, you know, of a superimposed figure. My theory is that Zelensky left Kiev around the 26th of February, along with, I know for a fact it was reported that both the NATO headquarters that was in Kiev and also the U.S. Embassy staff left and went first to Lviv, or Lviv as they call it now, and then to Warsaw within like 3-4 days. My theory is that Zelensky also went, and he's been there since then. If you look back at around the negotiations for the first meeting with the Russians, he insisted that it be in Warsaw. The Russians were willing to meet in Ukraine over the border from Belarus, and so I think that he's there. So the answer to your question would be, I think one of the objectives of sending Pelosi there is to provide the illusion that Zelensky hasn't left Ukraine. I think he has. And I think that that's something that people need to consider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, since we're running quickly out of time here, Alfred Desaias, so you have the U.S. close to $4 billion, if not a little bit more, just during the Biden presidency, looking for the $30 billion, which $20 billion will be the military assistance. And, of course, you have all the rest of the EU member states that have provided the military assistance on top of the sanctions. But then you have the news that comes out that says the ruble has become the best performing currency. Or when you have 10 EU countries that are quietly buying Russian gas, oil, of course, that could be replaced. At the same time, you have record sales coming through because of the high price of gas for Russia. They are not obviously getting the results that they wanted with these sanctions, and of course with all that military assistance. So doesn't that show that that's not going to work? That the Russia's money wheel is going to keep turning because obviously the sanctions have not had the impact, the intended impact that they wanted.
Well, I'm not even sure that they intended that. I mean, we live in a make-believe world. We know that sanctions do not work. Sanctions against Cuba have not worked in 61 years. Sanctions against Nicaragua in 42. Sanctions against Venezuela in 22 years. They have not induced a regime change. But we have to somehow show that we are strong and that we are defending our values and that we have a mission to bring democracy to Russia. And of course, sanctions, even if it leads to serial bankruptcies in Germany, in France, in the United Kingdom, it is the German businessman, it is the German industrialist who's losing money and tons of it because of these sanctions. The whole thing is sick. But again, you remember in Orwell's 1984, you have newspeak and you have doublethink and you have cognitive dissonance. Uh-huh. And you can believe at the same time that the sanctions will have some effect, even though empirically they're going to hurt you more than Russia.
Well, this is the part that is very confusing. Don DeBar, maybe you can clarify it for us. What would a win look like for either side, actually? What would winning look like for the U.S. When it comes to what it wants? Because it can't, obviously, based on just too many analysis that's been made, be able to push the Russian forces out of Ukraine. I mean, I'm looking at some of the stats here, 900,000 active personnel and 2 million reservists that Russia has, and also these are the favorable positions that it has in the east along with the air power. So what would a win look like for the U.S.? And at the same time, let's not leave Russia out of this. You know, what would a win for Russia look like? Because reports indicate that they have suffered massively when it comes to soldiers' lives and also equipment.
First of all, I don't believe the reports that are from here that they've had massive losses. But whatever that it is. I'll answer about Russia first because it's short. It's a shorter answer. A win for Russia is basically a pushback of the threat, the immediate threat to their security. That would be a withdrawal. I mean, they've been clear about what they want, a withdrawal of NATO forces. It really should go back to the other side of the Elbe River in Germany. But certainly the border countries should be neutralized, sort of a Finlandization, as the term is used now by some who hold themselves out as historians. And the abatement of the threat. For the United States, their goal, their objective is regime change in Russia. President Putin made clear that there will be no regime change in Russia, and having nothing to do with his personal presidency, but the Russian government was elected by the Russian people. They will choose their own form of government, and they have the weapons to defend themselves if there's a threat to an actual threat that happens to their security with respect to that, and they intend to use them. So what an American victory looks like, or the outcome, is either they accomplish regime change or there's a new art form around the world on the order of what they call Hiroshima shadows, only in cities across the United States and Europe and all over the world, okay. Which is too horrible to imagine, but is very close to happening.
30 seconds to you, Alfred Desaias, in conclusion. This is a world conflict now. You have shortages of energy. You have shortages of food. You have the IMF sounding off the alarm in Africa in terms of food insecurity, that there'll be social unrest. Countries around the world are suffering from either wheat, energy I mentioned, inflation, recession. Isn't this madness?
It is total madness, and it was predictable, and it was preventable because the proposals that Putin put on the table in December, which I read, were entirely moderate. And all he wanted was an European security architecture that would protect the rights of everybody, including Ukrainians and Russians. But the Americans didn't want that.
Okay.
I mean, it's been on our agenda change in Russia.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. That was Alfred Dzayas, lawyer, writer, historian, and former UN Special Rapporteur. Don DeBar, thank you so much. Activist and commentator from Westchester, New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وتوكل على الحي الذي لا يموت وسبح بحمده وكفى به بذنوب عباده خبيرا
And rely upon the ever-living who does not die and exalt Allah with his praise and sufficient is he to be with the sins of his servants acquainted.
Brothers and sisters, the 58th verse of Surah Al-Furqan says, وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتُ وَسَبِّحْ بِحَمْدِهِ وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ خَبِيرًا And rely on the ever-living one who dies not, and celebrate with his praise, and sufficient is he as being aware of the faults of his servants. This verse starts with the word تَوَكَّلْ, means rely on your Allah, and the Arabic word tawakkul and its derivatives are mentioned about 70 times in the Quran. It means to rely on Allah and to use Him as lawyer in all affairs. Anyway, as you were with us in the previous verses, the Holy Prophet ﷺ was commanded to tell people that he would not demand reward from them. And now in this verse, it is implied that religious leaders do not expect anything from people for their own lives, and they must all trust Allah and no one else. Therefore, in this verse, the main reliance of the Holy Prophet ﷺ is made clear. It says, وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتُ, and rely on the ever-living one who does not die. By having such a trust, by having such a guardian who is always alive and will be, the Prophet does not need their reward, does not fear them, does not fear their harm, hurt, and their conspiracies. Now that this is so, him his praise, do glorify him, praise him for all his perfect attributes. The verse continues, وَسَبِّحْ بِحَمْدِ رَبِّكَ, and celebrate with his praise. It means that when he has no fault and weakness, and he has got all the good things, and he is perfect, such a one is deserved to be trusted. So the verse says, وَسَبِّحْ بِحَمْدِ رَبِّكَ. This سَبِّح, celebrate, or hymn, means you have to respect your Allah and his attributes. And then it is added, implying that the Holy Prophet should not be worried of the enemy's conspiracies, because he suffices as the knower of his bondmen's sins, and he is the one who reckons them when it is time for them. So the verse continues, وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ خَبِيرًا, and sufficient is he as being aware of the faults of his servants. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter. تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
There are some small points to be discussed regarding this 58th verse of the chapter, dear listeners. Based on the attributes mentioned in this verse for Almighty Allah, we can understand three rules. First, reliance of the weak on the weak is unacceptable, because the verse says, تَوَكَّلْ عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتُ. Also, reliance of the ignorant on the one who is also ignorant is unacceptable, because at the end of the verse, we see the attribute خَبِيرًا. He is aware, so you must rely on someone who is aware. And also,
reliance of someone who is about to die on someone who is not everlasting is also unacceptable. Tawakkal ala al-hayy alladhi la yamut. Rely on him who is ever-living one, who does not die. So these three rules are understood based on the attributes of the Almighty Allah mentioned in this verse. The other point is, even the Holy Prophet, all the prophets, need sometimes to be advised. They need to be lectured for somehow restructuring their bonds with the Almighty Allah. Another point regarding the last sentence of the verse, which is very important, that says, وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ خَبِيرًا. And sufficient is he as being aware of the faults of the servants. From this very sentence, we can understand a couple of rules. First is that the Almighty Allah is looking at the sinners still as his servants. وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ. Even if you are a sinner, you're still his servant, so you have to stay hopeful of him. In this verse, the Almighty Allah is telling us how to control ourselves and how to reach piety. Believing in this fact that the Almighty Allah is sufficiently aware of all our smallest acts and deeds and sins is the best cause for reaching piety. And the last point, although this ending part of the verse is telling all the people, warning all of them, that the Almighty Allah is aware of your sins, but it is a kind of sympathy for the Holy Prophet ﷺ too. It means that you, Prophet, you should not worry because we are aware of how they are dealing with you and your followers, and we will chastise them for sure. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this program. There are some other points regarding the concept of trust that is mentioned in this verse that will be discussed later on. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subh Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
هذين البطلين اللذين نفذا عملية.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical, and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in north-occupied West Bank were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance. A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
French President Emmanuel Macron was inaugurated for his second term in a bitterly divided France. With a major portion of his voters aiming to block the far-right's Marine Le Pen, again, analysts say the first president to be re-elected in 20 years still lacks a broad mandate for more far-right economic policies. The Yellow Vests marched nationwide to send the message that they will not be intimidated or stop demanding more public opinion in public policies.
No, I'm never giving up, no. I've not been doing this for 3.5 years just so I can stop tomorrow. No way, no. Either we win or I die and these guys will carry on. people should never stop. They should keep going, keep going, keep going. Because this is what the governments are hoping. All governments are hoping that people give up and just let them do their thing.
The French left has put aside their squabbles and joined in a united coalition for the first time since 1936. Their goal is to prevent Macron and other conservatives from allying in another absolute majority in June's parliamentary elections. The left coalition hopes to force more compromise from a president long referred to as a liberal strongman.
Macron simply must not have a legislative majority again. The last 5 years were such a catastrophe. I hope the French people join us in the streets again because the prices of products are shamefully high, even products which are totally produced in France.
Macron's speech acknowledged the nation's disunity and said his key priorities will be the environment, the unrest in Ukraine, and European stability. The pan-European project continues to be plagued by perceptions of democratic illegitimacy and constantly rising economic inequality. A belligerent policy towards Russia may turn the Eurozone's ongoing lost decade into a lost score.
Macron's second term begins with unrest abroad, and if his first term is any guide, constant social unrest at home. Pitched social battles between Macron's far-right economic plans and a French populace unconvinced by economic austerity are expected to begin no later than this autumn. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
It's a warm welcome for an end to frosty ties. It's the second time in almost 3 years that Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau has visited Iran. His two-day trip began with a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The talks were held behind closed doors, while the two diplomats briefed reporters on the themes of the discussions, which ranged from economic ties to the Russo-Ukrainian war.
We talked on important issues today, on potentials for economic cooperation. We also spoke about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. I should thank Poland for hosting Ukrainian refugees in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Iran, for its part, has since day one called for a political solution to the crisis.
The Polish diplomat's trip comes on the 80th anniversary of the entry of Polish refugees into Iran during the thick of World War II. In 1942, Iran was a major landing point for some 120,000 Polish refugees who were forced out of Poland by the Soviet Union. Touching on the issue, the top Polish diplomat said Iran's hospitality created a cordial relationship between the two nations.
We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of Polish refugees from their land by the USSR. I should once again thank the Iranian nation who has hosted our countrymen, providing a safe haven for them for decades.
The Polish foreign minister underlined the significance of the 2015 deal in bringing peace, calling on both Iranian and American officials to arrive at an agreement as soon as possible.
Poland and Iran are looking forward to the success of the negotiations over the 2015 deal. When that happens, we will start extensive economic cooperation with Iran without worries over the sanctions.
Poland sits on a geostrategically important part of Eastern Europe. It could act as a gateway for Iran to trade with other European states. Iran, for its part, can also act as a gateway for Polish trade with the Middle East. The two sides cited lack of knowledge as the main reason behind their low trade, hoping that this trip will set the start for broader economic ties.
After decades of uneventful relations, Tehran and Warsaw are now determined to begin a new chapter in their ties. And this last visit by the Polish foreign minister is seen as the first step towards stronger ties between the two countries, something which could redefine the course of many unresolved issues, from the fate of the 2015 deal to Iran's ties with the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp," and prefer dying here than in a detention camp. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder.
According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather, kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy since the country has no refugee law. They urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Eilat, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Elad is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hail the successful and heroic operation in occupied Al-Quds and remind Israel that our people will respond to the regime's crimes.
President Mahmoud Abbas, however, condemned the operation and warned against the Israelis making this incident a pretext to target the Palestinians. The operation comes against the backdrop of the regime's intensified acts of violence across the occupied West Bank, including targeting Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. Over the past weeks, tensions have been running high at the mosque compound due to incursions by Israeli settlers protected by regime forces. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the latest attacks. Dozens have been arrested.
An occupying force continuously trample on the rights of a subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
As a consequence of Israel's atrocities, the Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities. An Israeli minister has said the regime suffered a very heavy price in the Elad operation. And now Israel has once again revved up its crackdown machine against the Palestinians through arresting dozens of people and closing the crossings to the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip, actions that will undoubtedly escalate the already tense circumstances in the occupied territories.
Casting their ballots before heading out to work. Britons having their say in an election that'll send thousands of representatives, conservative, labor, or liberal Democrat, to local councils.
This election, though, is not just about bin collections, access to hospitals and libraries, or the state of the roads. The fallout from the Partygate scandal and the cost of living crisis is looming large.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has apologized for COVID lockdown violations on his watch and acknowledged his government could do more to ease the blow to the public purse from soaring prices. But many, among them his party members, still want him gone, with a recent survey predicting heavy losses for the Conservatives.
Partygate is a big thing. I mean, Boris just lied through his teeth, and I find it really disgusting the way he's behaved, actually.
It's mostly down to the Conservatives, Boris Johnson over-promising, under-delivering, lying his way through. The recent Ukrainian refugees and Afghan refugees, where they promised to do so much and haven't done anything at all.
He has very little credibility. He's lied to Parliament, he's lied to the nation.
Main challenger Labour have been consistently leading in national polls for the past few months, but that might not translate into gains. Whether it's down to Brexit, COVID, or personality, Labour's new leader, Keir Starmer, is yet to reconnect with a large part of the country that deserted his party and voted Conservative in the 2019 general election.
They may make some gains, but I think that will be in spite of Sir Keir Starmer rather than because of him. And I think it really will be a reaction to the very poor way in which the Conservative government has actually been leading the country.
It won't be long before the results come out, and if the predictions turn out to have been right, then experts say it might be curtains for the Prime Minister. Saeed Bourza, London.
It was March 31st when the Italian government put an end to a 2-year state of emergency due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Just over a month later, some Italian media are reporting that the Mario Draghi government is mulling over issuing a new state of emergency linked this time to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Some newspapers have even suggested that Draghi is considering postponing next year's general elections. The Ukraine war and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Moscow, in addition to Rome's decision to significantly cut off its supply of Russian gas, have had a ferocious impact on Italy's already struggling economy.
A government of common sense always works on dealing with more than just one scenario. Suggesting the adoption of war economy and new laws.